Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for November 3rd, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with Brian McCaskill from Million Dollar Quartet. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. My special guest this week is the star and narrator of what I think is the one of the best shows in town. It's Million Dollar Quartet, which, in my view, is the number one jukebox musical that I have seen, and that includes Jersey Boys and Moving Out and many others. Say hello to Brian McCaskill.
Hi, everyone. How are you?
Hello, Brian.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Tell us about Million Dollar Quartet, because you have a unique role in this show, in your role and what the show is about.
The show is about a night that took place at Sun Records Recording Studio in Memphis, Tennessee, on December 4th in 1956, when a number of people who were discovered and produced by Sam Phillips, who was the founder and operator of Sun Records, came back for an impromptu jam session. It started off, Jerry Lee Lewis was there recording, and at this time in his career he was so broke, he literally was working for money to buy Christmas presents and to fix his broken car. And he was having a session, and then within that session Carl Perkins showed up to record. And then Elvis was in town, so he dropped by, and Johnny Cash dropped by as well. So all of those guys, the Memphis Press Scimitar later, the newspaper in Memphis later dubbed them the Million Dollar Quartet, but they all showed up for an impromptu jam session that Sam rolled the tapes on, so he recorded it. So for posterity.
And you're playing Sam Phillips.
And I'm playing Sam Phillips.
Tell us about Sam, because he's the narrator, and he's also... the book. You know, one of the complaints in jukebox musicals is, well, they should just be reviews, just do the shows. But this is a unique event that actually happened.
It did, yes.
And Sam Phillips was considered, what, the father of rock and roll? Tell us about Sam.
He's a self-proclaimed father of rock and roll. He's not a modest guy, but he is also a genius. He's there's a dichotomy to Sam Phillips. There's you'll see interviews with him later on, mainly in the 80s and 90s. There's not a lot from the actual period, of course, but... he was somebody who put the fear of God into people, and he's also someone that people absolutely adored and loved. People described him as the best friend. They also described him as firing them three times in one day. The thing he was a genius at was taking a raw or unusual sound, which with rock and roll at this time and rockabilly, taking a Western swing country style and mixing it with blues and these guys all had very unusual voices, not trained singers by any, you know, in the classic sense. Very unusual sounds, and he was very good at picking those out and accentuating those and finding ways to work within this tiny studio that was formerly an auto parts store.
It was literally a storefront.
Yeah, it was
a recording studio.
Yeah, and if you ever go to Sun, our set, which is small, if you ever go to Sun Studio, it's about the same size. It's tiny. The amazing thing about Sun Studio and Sun Records, if you ever go visit it in Memphis, people think it's the cafe next door was part of it too. It's not. That was added later. But it's tiny. It's absolutely tiny. And the number of important artists who came through there is incredible. In fact, Sam's credited for recording what some people consider the first rock and roll record, Rocket 88, which Dale Brenston with Ike Turner on piano, which had a great, raw, ugly sound to it, but it was because one of the guys dropped their speakers on the way to the session, so it's a busted speaker cone. It sounds really weird and fuzzy and very hard rock, but Sam liked it and wanted to keep it.
So he had a real ear for the new genre of this
rock music.
Absolutely.
Elvis was somebody at the time who had a very nasally whine. People did not want to record him. Jerry Lee Lewis had been to five other recording studios, and they kicked him
out.
So
he discovered these guys, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I mean,
definitely.
He's the man that put Elvis on the map.
Yeah, and he nurtured them, too. Oddly enough, he considered his greatest discovery Howlin' Wolf, which if you listen to Howlin' Wolf and you think about Sam's style, which is a very sort of threadbare, raw, very from the soul gut kind of sound, Howlin' Wolf typifies that.
Yes, he does.
But Howlin' Wolf went off to, he recorded two records, or a record and a flip side for Howlin' Wolf, and then he went off to Chess Records.
So here we are. We're December 4th, 1956, and it's really supposed to be Jerry Lee Lewis's session.
Yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis is playing it. Well, Jerry Lee Lewis is coming in to do piano work while Carl Perkins records a session.
Carl Perkins records, okay.
Yeah.
And then Johnny Cash shows up, right?
Mm-hmm. Johnny Cash shows up.
And for a special reason, which you can maybe tell us about later. And then Elvis is in town.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they just all started jamming.
Yeah, they did. And when you listen to the actual Million Dollar Quartet sessions, what is kind of fun about it? Johnny Cash, you can't hear him as well on the actual sessions. He was probably standing back further from the mic, although there's reports that he was closer to the mic earlier in the session, but the tape wasn't rolling. So there's sort of like a holy grail of like some missing tape out there somewhere, possibly, of this session, if Sam recorded it. But there's a lot of talk. Johnny Cash, in his own biography, I think, said he was the first to show up. Other people said, no, he was the last to show up. It's amazing how many different stories of who showed up and when come out of this.
So this live show is based on an actual event.
Oh, absolutely.
And an actual recording.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you heard the recordings?
Yes, I've heard the recordings. What's interesting is, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis is very contentious in it and challenges a lot of people, and he was not a star at the time. And what's interesting, when you listen to Million Dollar Quartet sessions, he kind of goes at it with Elvis. Like, Elvis is singing at the mic, and you hear Jerry Lee Lewis get really close to the mic and really belt some songs out. And it's very funny, because he's challenging him on some of those sessions. It's kind of, when you see the play and then listen to those sessions again, it's interesting to hear Jerry Lee Lewis jumping at the mic as much as
he can. And Carl Perkins and Elvis kind of have there's a little friction there.
There is in the play. In real life, there was not as much, but there was certainly...
It was over Blue Suede Shoes, wasn't it?
Over Blue Suede Shoes, yeah, which became a big hit for Elvis Presley, but it was actually written and recorded originally by Carl Perkins. But it was the first million seller for Sun Records. It was hugely important record for Sun Records. It did really put them on the map.
So tell us why Sam Phillips had this problem. He starts out with these guys. He nurtures them. He kind of moves them up from obscurity and takes them out, puts shoes on them and takes them out of the shacks and kind of educates them. And then they leave them.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well,
because that's part of what goes on in the play, too.
I think it's the nature. The thing that Sam has always said, which I think there's a lot of truth to, is that with the size of his operation, which was basically a two-person operation, it was basically him and then Jack Clement, who was a recording engineer of his, who recorded a lot of Jerry Lee Lewis's sessions, and he also wrote Ballad of a Teenage Queen, which is in the show. They were basically running the joint. Sam was working with his brother for a while, Judd Phillips, but then Judd left the business. So basically, it was he had these massive stars that even Columbia and RCA wouldn't know, would have difficulty in managing, and Sam's such a small independent that it was impossible for him to, he couldn't, distributors always paid late. That was just the nature of the business. You'd sell the records, and then they pay you late.
So it's a cash flow.
It's a cash flow issue.
Yeah.
And with Sam, that was a real issue. So he was almost completely bankrupt. I say in the play, as Sam, that I couldn't even buy presents for my wife, Becky, and my two boys last Christmas. That's true.
And he
was almost dead
didn't
broke.
Didn't he also have he would get focused on one star at a time, kind of, right?
Yeah, but sometimes that's out of necessity. Okay. The thing was, he had six records out at one point. During Elvis's tenure there, and three of them were Elvis Presley records. So, I mean, he put his money where it should be in that case.
Okay.
But some artists probably were underdeveloped as a result, and some artists got very jealous about it. And even when Jerry Lee Lewis came along, Sam has said that Perkins and Cash were jealous over the attention that Sam was paying to Jerry Lee.
Okay.
And that's with that small of an operation, it would be impossible to give everyone individualized attention
in a way,
as much.
He probably knew that he was only going to have him so long that the big guys were going to kind of buy him out.
Yeah, and for Steve Scholes over at RCA negotiating the Elvis deal, it was $35,000 to Sam and $5,000 royalties to Elvis, so it was $40,000, which at that time is an astronomical amount of money. I think the nearest competitor, which was A&R, which is much smaller than, was offering like $20,000. People thought Steve Scholes over at RCA was crazy. I mean, Elvis had, you know, maybe like five records at the time out with flip sides, and they're like, that's not worth $40,000. You're insane. And people did think rock and roll is going to go away. This is a fad.
So today it'd be like $4 million or something.
Yeah, it's an insane amount for based on the track record at the time. It's a lot of money.
So one of the things that I liked about Million Dollar Quartet is not only is it musically astronomical. I mean, the musician's good, and we'll talk about each one in a minute, but that you weave this narrative, this book. That this is more than just a review, because it is Sam Perkins' story and Philip's story, and it's the story of the starting out of each of these legends.
Yeah,
and the way you weaved it in your character, where you narrate and then you weave in and out of the music, and I thought it was just beautifully staged.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. That has a big part to do with Colin S. Scott's script and Floyd Mutrix's script and Colin S. Scott's book too. Because he wrote the book Sun Records with Martin Hawkins. It's called Good Rockin' Tonight, Sun Records and the Birth of Rock and Roll. It's the title of it, excuse me. And he took the stories from that he was told. There's so much in that book that actually ends up in the play. And the way it's woven together, he's done such a nice job because these are all stories that happen at disparate times, so the flashback sequences work really nicely with the music. And the underscoring of the music works really well, too, and that's a credit to the direction and the musical direction.
You know. Yeah, let's talk about some of your co-stars. I bet you never thought you'd be in a musical, right?
My agent told me I had an audition for this, and I knew what it was. I was familiar with all these guys. It's called Million Dollar Quartet. I said, with Elvis and those guys? He's like, yeah. I'm like, clearly they don't want me to sing. And they're like, no, they want you to read for Sam Phillips. I said, oh, okay, because I knew who Sam Phillips was.
Oh, okay.
And then I was like, that makes sense. Because when he said Million Dollar Quartet, I was like, I thought maybe somebody thought maybe I could sing or play an instrument, and I was going to correct them.
No.
But then when I found out it was Sam Phillips, I'm like, oh, okay, it's a speaking role. He's like, yes. I'm like, all right.
Well, it's the lead role. I mean,
it's a great role.
And you do a terrific job with
Thank you.
You could tell that that they had this respect for you. Not only is it written, but I mean, you're commanding on stage.
Yeah,
and
thank
you. That makes a difference,
too. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about these talents. But besides being excellent actors, these guys are great musicians.
They're phenomenal.
One of the things that I got to tell folks is it's not only a good book, but boy, this will blow you away musically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not dubbed music. It's all done live on stage.
Yeah.
So we've got, who's playing Jerry Lee Lewis?
Levi Kreis. Okay. He's an amazing pianist, amazing piano player. And he's a great actor. He's hilarious, too. He's got phenomenal comic timing.
Yes,
and
he does.
Which is great for Jerry Lee Lewis.
Oh, yeah. Jerry Lewis was a wild and crazy guy.
He was nuts. Yeah. And Levi's great. Levi's great at doing it. And it is virtuoso playing. It really is amazing what he can do with a set of piano keys,
and
with that character.
And then Carl Perkins' character.
Rob Lyons, who did not, they told me Rob Lyons did not play rockabilly when he started this project, because he did it in previous incarnations in Seattle. I'm not sure if he did the Florida production. I know he was in the Seattle production.
Yes, that's why I understand it.
Yeah, and he did not play rockabilly music. He actually picked up this stuff later and learned it. He always loved the guitar.
Yeah, and he's a good lead guitar player.
Yeah, he's electrical. Phenomenal. Basically, he learned all this through Chuck Mead, who's an amazing musical director, too. So.
And then we have playing Johnny Cash, Lance Guest.
Lance Guest, yeah. And Lance is phenomenal, too. Lance, really, the thing about Lance that he has going, too, is the thing with a lot of these guys is people know them so well, and the thing that Lance has is he's got a nice, really great hook into Johnny Cash, in the sense that even when he's talking, he sounds like Johnny Cash.
Yeah,
when
he does. Sings, he's got that thing. Big baritone.
Yeah, him. And Johnny Cash is a hard one to emulate, particularly when singing, because a lot of people, when they impersonate him, it can sound kind of flat. And the nice thing about Lance is it's not an impersonation. It's really he's doing a version of Johnny Cash, but it sounds so much like him. It's great.
And playing Elvis?
Eddie Clendenning, yeah. Eddie is great. The thing about Eddie is, and I love, one of the things I love about the script is the way Colin wrote this in. Elvis doesn't, because Elvis, everybody's expecting Elvis to arrive and like boom through the doors. And I like the fact that Elvis kind of sneaks in, because it's that quiet Elvis, too.
It was the early Elvis when he's still very shy. And really, Elvis is the most minor player in this scenario.
Well, he's different. He's just everybody has opinions about him. You know, things, the important, like a lot of things happen based on what people think about Elvis. You know what I mean? But it affects how all the characters act. Elvis is not necessarily coming in and causing problems. Elvis was just that massively successful that he affects everyone in that room.
Even
because
though,
of his legacy, which has already begun.
Right, even though Eddie played him kind of very laid back, as Elvis was, and
yeah.
shy.
Yeah, and the nice thing is it's not the great thing. I mean, Eddie really is doing a great job because it's not that, it's not at all, there's so many people who know Elvis, and there's so many people who would do an impersonation, and he's just so naturally got that vibe. I mean, some actors would kill for that. That's just that sort of natural sort of, because it'd be so tempting to just do an Elvis impersonation.
Yeah, and that's what I like about all of them is they play in the style of, and they, but they put their own little twist. So it isn't impersonation.
No, not at all. And that's the great thing, because that could be deadly in a way to the show, because it could kill a lot of the momentum. And it could kill a lot of the liveliness of the live performances and the songs, you know, which they bring a lot to that. So.
And let's add Kelly Lamont is Elvis's girlfriend who sings a couple of songs.
Yeah.
Is that... Was she part of the original story, or was that...
She was, but she's more of a composite in this case.
Okay.
The original, Elvis's original girlfriend was Marilyn Evans, and she was a starlet. She wasn't a showgirl. She wasn't a singer.
Okay.
In this case, she is a singer. But the interesting thing about Marilyn Evans, she's kind of... I think people... Colin, one of the playwrights, had said that she's the ghost that kind of unites everyone. Because she was never heard from since then. And all of Elvis's girlfriends have been heard. People have contacted her constantly, like, what happened? What happened at this session? Nobody can find her. She basically disappeared the next day, Marilyn Evans. Nobody knows where she went.
That's interesting.
That's very interesting.
There's a challenge for some reporter. There's a story there.
There's something out there.
And then let's add the two musicians that are the bass player and the percussion drummer.
Yeah, Chuck Zayas, an amazing upright bass player, and Billy Bob Schaefer, an amazing drummer. Both of those guys are phenomenal, and they just came in and just like blew everyone away. They're so quick and so fast to learn, and they're so tight. They're such a tight rhythm section. And then Billy Bob, we had Billy Bob coming in and learning this stuff, some of the stuff at the last minute, and he was just phenomenal. He was just the natural ear for it, both those guys. And they're even, you know, they're fun to play with on stage and stuff like that, and those musical performances and even off the acting stuff.
Musically, this is as good a show as anyone will see
anywhere.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It really
those
is.
Guys are phenomenal. Yeah.
And the reason to come is just to hear the music. Mm-hmm. And guess what? You'll leave having seen a good play.
They
inform you of a lot of
things. Yeah, and there's a lot of – the thing is there's the thing about Colin's book, too, the Good Rockin' Tonight – is there's so many fascinating details. You do want to cram them all in there, but there's a lot that are in here about these guys and how they came about and their stories. And that's the thing that I think that fascinates people. And at the end, there's people see a picture at one point during the play of the Million Dollar Quartet, and it always sort of like it throws people. There's always a vocal response, which is interesting. I've always seen that picture, but I think people are like, I don't know if it's a realization like, oh my God, this really happened, or wow, somebody got a picture of this, but people are just like, it throws them for a loop, you know? And actually, Marilyn is cropped out of that photo. She's sitting
is
on
that
the end,
right?
She was sitting on the end of the piano,
okay,
Elvis's girlfriend, yeah.
What's the response has been? Because I know the show's had a successful run at the Goodman, and it's going to be opening up, the opening is November 5th at the Apollo Theater.
Yeah, preview's October 31st,
right.
Opens November 5th. The response has been amazing. It really has. It's like a rock concert. It's like that kind of response, which I'm not used to in doing theater.
Yeah.
You get some nice responses. You get some standing ovations. But people really do, you know, standing up and dancing and really screaming. And the other thing that's interesting is they scream for these guys in their characters' names. I was surprised one night somebody said, "Hey, Sam." And that was weird to me. But they constantly say, "Jerry Lee, Johnny, Elvis." They're always like screaming, "Carl, go, Carl." They're calling them out in character. You know what I mean?
I was surprised at the press opening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every critic in town was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, generally, you know, we're polite and we like a show.
Sure.
But the response even among all of us was just amazing.
Yeah.
Because it brought back an era for me. I was 12 years old in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to a lot of that music, and
sure.
I loved it because it was rhythmatic. It wasn't like rock and roll became later when it became some of that stuff that's lacks kind of rhythms and it's hard to understand the lyrics. These guys were great musicians too.
Yeah. Well, the amazing thing though too is like when you're talking about the later rock too, at that time people were like it was so alien. It really was. It was shocking, it was brutal, and people thought this won't last. You know, in my lifetime, compared to like punk rock when it came out, it's like, whoa. You know, everybody's like, wait, that's too aggressive. That's too much. And really, Jerry Lee talks at a point about people talking in tongues and stuff like that, like in church. It is the flip side of that. It's people talking in tongues. Like girls screaming and crying and fainting. I mean, that's frightening. It really was a strange, weird time. And Sam had that in.
What's great about the music of this era, I mean, in this show, is not only see Blue Suede Shoes, but you see the Rock Island Line, which is real country, and That's All Right. And even great songs as the show builds up. And I do like the way they spread the songs around. So everybody got their songs, and in between, music would fade a little bit, and you would come up with the narration and, you know, keep the story going. But then it really gets rolling. Yeah. Great Balls of Fire and See You Later, Alligator, those old rhyming.
Yeah.
The stuff.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's the thing between the great thing is like you know, Chuck Mead handling the musical direction. He's phenomenal,
and
he made these guys a band. And Eric Schaefer was great at was phenomenal at taking everyone and putting them together and making it cohesive. And some guys who didn't have a few of them did not have as much acting experience and making all that gel together, making these two worlds.
Because the dilemma they had.
Yeah.
And this is what I was worried about coming into seeing this show. I hope they're not going to be hokey impersonators, and they're not. And I hope they're not going to be terrible musicians or faking musicians where they have to dub the music in. Because I just saw that in Dirty Dancing for $100 a ticket. And that's, you kind of wonder.
Yeah.
But then if you get musicians, what about actors? And I thought these guys were much better actors than I expected.
Oh, yeah. When I heard they were going to be playing their own instruments, I was like, oh, gosh. Who's this? I mean, you don't know.
Yeah,
you
don't
think,
know.
Like, well, these are going to be really good musicians probably and good singers, but they're great actors too. And it's great because it's very easy to work with them. And Eric was great at pulling everyone together and getting them on the same page in the scenes. You know,
well, I'm sure that helped you being this top experienced actor you are. I'm sure that helped in the process, right?
It did
help. Did you give him a few tips?
No. I mean, Eric was better at that. I actually, the thing was, they had raw things that's, like I said, with like Eddie. Like, Eddie's got that raw vibe that a lot of actors would kill for, you know?
Yeah.
So you don't want to, I wouldn't want to mess with that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's up to Eric to like tweak and you know, pull that around and stuff like that, because he's already got something that's a great natural vibe. Levi's already got phenomenal timing. Lance has got a great emotional hook into Johnny Cash, you know. So Kelly's got great, you know, great vibe as Diane is sort of like.
But
know,
she can belt.
She can belt.
Fever and it's terrific.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it's a tough character to play because it's like everyone else is based on someone. You're a composite of someone who disappeared the next day. That's tough to play.
Yeah.
You're Elvis's girlfriend.
But it's cool she put her mark on that.
Yeah. And you know, when they're together, when Kelly and Eddie are on stage together, they've got a great vibe as that couple. I always buy that they're boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah, I
and
do
that's
too.
That's hard to do. They have that sort of chemistry right away, you know. And they do. They have it all the way through.
So it looks like you're having a good time.
I'm having a blast.
It's opening at the Apollo, and you're running all the way through January.
January 4th. Yes. Yeah.
And I think this show is going to be really terrific.
Thank you.
And
it's been
successful. Because with the tough economy and with the holidays, this is the kind of show, folks, give this a priority.
Yeah, and it's even set around Christmas time.
Yeah,
and there's a toast in it for New Year's.
That's
I mean,
right.
It's totally, it is. It really is built for the holidays. No matter what, anybody walks away from it, everybody says it is a feel-good show.
Yes.
No matter what,
I have yet to hear anybody. And the word on the street is very strong on the show. Mm-hmm. And then when people mention to me or they ask me what's the best thing in town, and I say. In musicals, it's Million Dollar Quartet.
Excellent.
You know, I like Amadeus and you know, a few others. But in terms of the other musicals, this is where you need to be. And so you're opening at the Apollo Wednesday through Sundays, right?
Yes, Wednesdays through Sundays.
And you do two on Wednesday and...
two on Wednesday, one on Thursday and Friday, and then two on Saturday and Sunday. So our two show days, our matinee days are Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then evenings Wednesday through Sunday.
Wow, it's eight show week. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, but you know what? When it's fun, it's not coal mining. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
when it comes down to it.
And it
looks
like the musicians are having a great time out
there,
too.
They are
having
a great time. And those are the guys who are, really, I mean, I've got to exert some energy, but, you know, the guys who are jumping around and jumping up and down on these instruments, they're really, you know, they're busting their humps out there and stuff like that. You know, Levi's losing his fingernails. He's got nail hardener and Band-Aids and stuff that he tapes up his fingers. I mean, they're blisters and stuff like that. Their feet, they really are. They're really
congratulations
throwing themselves on the sword.
I can see that. I was going to ask you how you prepare for the role, but you've already told me. I mean, you knew a lot about this, and you had read about Sam
Yeah, my
Phelps.
Folks are from Tennessee. That helped a lot. And
okay.
They grew up on this music, you know. So my mom loved the show.
Oh, she did love it.
Yeah. But and, really, and my mom will tell me, my mom will come to some of my shows and say, well, it's all right, Brian.
Yeah, you were good, right?
She liked me. She said, it's interesting because I don't necessarily see Sam as a nice guy. She said, it was nice to see you play a nice guy. But I always play pretty dark characters.
Yeah,
so it is kind of a nicer guy.
You sure
I guess.
Yeah. So. Well, let's talk about Brian McCaskill as an actor.
Sure, why not?
You've been on my radar for a long time to get to talk to you one of these podcasts. I was just waiting for the right role. And boy, as soon as I saw that 5 minutes into the show, I said to a friend of mine, that's my next interview.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
And but I loved you in a lot of shows. Judgment at Nuremberg, mm-hmm. American Buffalo.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
You were terrific in that.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
Yeah.
That's a fun, Cheech is a really fun role. I love Mamet.
Yeah, I heard some stories about some of the fight scenes in there. Got a little carried away some nights, huh?
Well, you know, the thing was when they give you real shovels and you know, you know, baseball bats and stuff like that. You know, Mike Menendian, the artistic director over there, basically, you know, he put like a whole junk shop on stage. And
yes, he did. It was an amazing set.
Yeah, and he said, trash it. You know, do what
and
you want.
And you and Rich Kowalski certainly
did. Yeah, we
did.
We did. But the fight choreography on that was, it took a lot of work, and you had to be very careful because there was so much. When you're taking a shovel to someone and you're pretending to hit them in the head and they got to knock back and stuff like that,
yeah.
You really do have to.
Yeah.
And it's a heavy shovel and there's a heavy bat and then you're swinging, you know, pig irons and stuff like that. It gets, you know, you got to be careful.
Well, I liked you in Dealer's Choice and then you were
a fun
in the
one.
Ballad of Emmett Till.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So tell us, what are some of your favorite roles?
Some of my favorite roles. Actually, American Buffalo is definitely one.
Okay.
I love Mamet. Glenn Ross played Roma in that.
Yeah, you were strong in that.
Thank you. Judgment at Nuremberg. I like playing Herr Rolf a lot because it's a complicated.
What a great
character.
Play that was!
It is a great play.
That was
and
one of the best plays in that couple
yeah.
of years. Yeah,
I had a great time doing that, and it's an interesting, you know, basically defending Nazi war criminals. It's a very and you know right after the war in Germany. It's very. There's a lot of strange territory to navigate there.
Who can forget that scene when you're really hounding on the. On the one witness
and yeah,
Maury
Scott
Cooper,
him,
yeah, Maury Cooper jumps up.
Yeah,
wow, that was a great moment.
Oh yeah, that was was going after.
I think it was one of the women.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
But I don't remember who that
I know,
was.
I know, it's been so long.
But I remember you were pounding, and
it
just reminded him. You got into a tempo, reminded him of Hitler, I think.
Yeah,
and then he had enough, and he had been silent all the way through. That was one of those great. One of those great dramatic moments.
Maury was someone. I love working with Maury. Maury's just one of those guys. It's just he's instinctually just like you know he comes in like it'll be the first time he's reading something. And it's like wow, it's like he's prepared something, but he do it off the cuff.
Yeah, well,
you know he's amazing.
60 years in the business.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. Doesn't hurt.
So tell us what else you liked.
I did like Dealer's Choice was a fun one just because of that one actually involved a poker game on stage.
Yes.
And you know that one was. It was just very well crafted, so it was a fun one to do, and I like the way the playwright used the characters to get them on and off through the poker game, and how the drama happened subtextually through the game.
Yeah,
it's kind of a cool acting exercise.
Yeah, it's a good
everything
script,
happens
yes.
through
mm-hmm.
this poker
through
game,
this poker game
rather
right.
than voicing what you're thinking. You got to do it through the poker game. So that was a fun challenge. I like playing Orson Welles a lot too, and It's All True. But I love working with Lou Conti and I love working with Mike Menendian. They're great directors. They have natural insights into actors, and they're just we share kind of the same vibe and sort of the same attitude. So anytime I get a chance to work with those guys, I always enjoy it. So it's interesting. Sometimes it does link up with directors a lot who you like, and I like working with Steve Scott a lot on Dealer's Choice.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's just when you get that vibe, it's just nothing can beat it when you really gel with the director.
Well, it's great when you're working with top people like that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I've been very lucky.
So this Million Dollar Quartet is really kind of almost a holiday for you, right? Moving into an acting role in a musical.
Yeah, it
so
is.
So now you can
it
put is. On your resume, you've done a musical, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, everyone, if you know me, you'll know that I was speaking in a musical. But yeah, no, it's great. It's a lot of fun. And the thing I like about it is it definitely has some sort of – it has surreal sort of moments like a musical will where all of a sudden somebody takes off in a song. There's more setups where people are coming in saying, I'm going to sing right now. But there's some moments when they sing Peace in the Valley and when Kelly comes in and sings, just takes control of that room mm-hmm. before she sings Fever, that are true like sort of musical moments. So those are really fun because I do – You know, I love surrealism, but I don't get a chance to do it much because I can't sing and I can't dance, so they don't let me do it.
Well, but
wisely.
But you snuck into a musical.
I snuck in under the radar. Believe me, no one was as surprised as me. I thought, well, I'm going to go, you know, I'll go audition. I like Sam Phillips. So I hope I get it. We'll see what happens. But I wasn't planning on it.
But you were the right guy for the role.
Thank you. It feels like a great match with all these guys and with the script and all.
Okay, in the few moments we have left, sure, Tell us where you want to be in 5 years. Like, what kind of roles you want to do, or what you want to do professionally?
Oh God. Well, you know what? I would like to keep working. I'm sure every actor says this. I wouldn't mind directing. I wouldn't mind writing.
No, some say there. I've had a few actors don't want any part of it, but you wouldn't mind directing.
Not at all.
And then writing.
There's times when I think, with certain things, I want to be. I'm more interested sometimes in being on the other side, so that definitely crops into my head. And just, you know, gainfully employed. I've been very lucky, with the combination of the work through my agency and the plays and stuff like that. I've been able to get by really, you know, quite nicely sometimes. You know, which is good for me.
You can make a living as an actor.
Yeah, I mean, the neighborhood I came from, I thought it was going to end up in construction or factory work. So this is working out just fine. You know, it's a lot easier.
All right, what are a couple of the roles that you'd love to play?
That I'd love to play. Oh, you know, they tend to come and go. They kind of. I would have to think about, you know, what they would be offhand. I've never had. There's stuff I know I would love to direct.
Okay.
That's an easier question for me, actually.
Right.
Like Lulu is one by Frank Vedekin, the guy who wrote Spring's Awakening.
Yes.
I would love to direct that. And there's a Russian play called Sacred Blood.
I don't know that.
Nobody knows it.
Well, that's why you
I
should do
it.
You have you have a vision for it.
Yes.
Good.
And that would be a phenomenal play to direct. Yeah, it's a lot easier for me to my interest in directing always.
How about,
like,
Shakespeare
surpasses.
Or Chekhov or
oh,
Oscar
yeah.
Wilde?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I would love to. I would love to do Uncle Vanya. I would love to. I would. I know everybody says it. You know, it's a popular one, but another one is Macbeth. But the thing is, because of the way those plays are, they are. I think Titus Andronicus is a challenge because it's so messed up a play in a way.
Yeah. Oh, in a lot of ways.
But, you know, revenge is so messed up and so many people feel those sort of things. I think there's a way into that. I think it's hard to make accessible, but I think it's a challenging play and it can be an interesting play.
I could see you at Chicago Shakespeare, particularly playing villains. That might be your entree in.
Please, pass my name on. Have them give me a call.
Well,
that'd be great.
I'm sure the folks over there have seen you in that. But it's so great that you're having such a good time with this show.
I'm having a blast.
I think this show is going to run a long time. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. There's already the buzz on the street is very strong for it.
Great.
And I think moving to the Apollo is going to help because it's got a good sound and it's a nice theater.
I think so too. I think it's a great venue for it because some shows you get it's about 400 or so seats. I don't know the exact number, but sometimes you get those big theaters with the nosebleed seats. The nice thing about this is you are close to all these guys in this cramped studio where it took place, and you get to see these guys jump up and down and, you know, on their instruments and
just
play like maniacs.
It'll musically blow you away without overpowering you.
Yeah.
It doesn't overpower you. The sound, it's got a very pure sound because they're actually playing.
Yeah.
Because I remember
amazing.
I remember it was Hetty Weiss and someone else went and checked to make sure because the sound was so good. I think it was Hetty said the sound was so good.
Yeah.
Musicianship, she wanted to know if it was enhanced, and it wasn't.
Yeah, I've had
and
a lot
I looked
of
around for that in the first song or two. And my friend who's a musician was with me. He's watching. He goes, no, they're playing. You know, you can watch it. You can only fake the hand movements on the guitar
so
much.
A lot of people have asked that,
yeah.
It's that good.
Yeah.
It sounds phenomenal.
Yeah, because it sounds like that it's been done in a recording studio,
sure.
And it's
and
live.
As physical as these guys are while they're playing, it sounds like they should be more winded.
Or
out of breath, and they never sound that way.
No, they don't.
I really don't know how they do it. I drink a lot of coffee, and I couldn't do that. So I don't know how they do it.
Well,
so,
folks, get to the Apollo, and you can. The phone number is 773-935-6100, or you can go to Million Dollar Quartet's website or our Theater in Chicago website to get information. Folks, do not miss this show. You'll come out and have so much fun. You'll be telling your friends, and you'll come back and see it a second time. I'm sure you've had a lot of people.
I've had people. It's like Rocky Horror. People yell out lines sometimes.
Oh,
some people have yelled out lines before they've been said.
Wow.
Yes,
that says a lot.
Yeah.
All right, Brian. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, folks. And remember, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of November 3rd, 2008. Broadway in Chicago has announced they will host the world premiere of The Addams Family. Performances begin Friday, November 13th, 2009, at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts, the Oriental Theater. The Addams Family will play a limited engagement here in Chicago through that following January prior to its opening on Broadway. The new musical was based on the bizarre family of characters created by legendary cartoonist Charles Addams. His career spanned six decades, and many of his drawings were famously published in The New Yorker. The Addams Family is part of the Broadway in Chicago season. Subscription tickets to new subscribers will go on sale this November 21st. The sale of individual tickets will be announced at a later date, so stay tuned right here to Theater in Chicago News for those future announcements. The current economic conditions are affecting future theater plans. The new 299-seat Proscenium Theater in Lincoln Park, which was slated to open next fall, will not be able to make that deadline. However, it will open in due course of time. The state-of-the-art facility is the future residence of Porchlight Music Theater. In regional news, Milwaukee Shakespeare Theater is unfortunately closing its doors and canceling the rest of their shows. After nine seasons, the company will not be receiving any more funding from the Argosy Foundation, so they can no longer continue to operate. If you had season subscription tickets to the Milwaukee Shakespeare Theater, get in contact with the MST box office. They will honor the unused portion of your subscription. And in final news, the legendary Studs Terkel has passed away this past Friday at the age of 96. He was a very important figure to Chicago theater and Chicago theater history. He will be greatly missed. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Brian McCaskill for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.